When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Welcome to another Endocrine Surgery Podcast. I'm Barb Miller from The Ohio State University. I'll be your moderator today. I'll be joined today by the rest of our endocrine surgeons here at Ohio State, Dr. John Fay, Clinical Professor of Surgery, Dr. Priya Dedia, Assistant Professor of Surgery, and also joining us is Dr. Vanilla Padmanabhan, one of our current Complex General Surgery Oncology Fellows. Pregnancy is a state of complex physiologic changes. Additional endocrine and surgical disorders are discovered during pregnancy and can present a risk of maternal and fetal harm and spontaneous pregnancy loss. The stakes are higher when assessing and treating these endocrine disorders during pregnancy, given multiple factors to consider and can be confusing or lead to more uncertainty and stressful decision-making for surgeons and other members of the treating medical team. It takes good multidisciplinary communication and nuanced consideration to manage endocrine disease in the preconception, pregnancy, and postpartum periods. And this should be an interesting and engaging analysis of available literature regarding common endocrine disorders. In the first part, we'll consider evaluation and management of thyroid nodules, hyperthyroidism, thyroid cancer, and primary hyperparathyroidism. In the second part of this podcast series, we'll tackle pheochromocytoma, adrenocortical cancer, and the rare but mechanistically interesting adrenally mediated Cushing syndrome during pregnancy. We're looking forward to a robust discussion. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
So, Vanilla, to set the stage, can you highlight the physiologic changes during pregnancy that impact thyroid function outlined in the 2017 ATA guidelines? We'll have a link to these excellent guidelines for the care of the pregnant patient on the podcast page. These are also available and free on the American Thyroid Association website. Why don't you give us a quick overview of what the guidelines cover in general, and then we'll briefly review the major physiologic changes surgeons should try to take away from this podcast.
Yeah, sure. So during pregnancy, the thyroid gland normally increases in size about 10 to 40%. And so the accurate assessment of thyroid function differs not unexpectedly from the non-pregnant patient. So interestingly, beta-HCG has the same structure as TSH, and estrogen stimulates thyroid binding globulin. And so the net effect is an increase in T4 and T3 levels. Now, in the first trimester, thyroid hormone levels actually increase. This is an expected physiologic change. And so throughout the pregnancy, trimester-specific assays should be applied, and iodine status of the patient needs to be considered. Now, it's not really uncommon to see an increased incidence of thyroid autoantibodies develop. And this is seen both as the development of Hashimoto's thyroiditis and Graves' disease, which increases in frequency during pregnancy. Just to confound these diagnoses, patients may also have gestational transient thyrotoxicosis. And when patients do develop true or abnormal thyrotoxicosis, this can have really bad effects on the pregnancy, including pregnancy loss. It can cause gestational hypertension, prematurity, low birth weight, intrauterine growth retardation, and thyroid storm in both the mother and the fetus. Additionally, several severe and prolonged maternal hyperthyroidism can occasionally lead to fetal seizures and neurobehavioral disorders in the child, as well as poor fetal thyroid development. And so there's many things to consider in the occurrence of hyperthyroidism in pregnant patients. Now, there are fetal endocrine abnormalities that can develop both on their own and as a result of maternal endocrine disorders. So we should be aware of that, but we don't really have time to get into that today. For thyroid issues, ultrasound can identify goiters that may compress the airway and become an issue immediately after birth.
So any comments, John or Priya? You know, we all see patients who are pregnant takes, you know, a little bit of extra thinking when we're thinking about either an operation or does somebody need an operation or not. You know, anything you remember in particular about maternal fetal physiology when evaluating thyroid disorders?
Well, one thing I always counsel my patients about before they get pregnant, when we're talking about lifelong thyroid hormone replacement, if they're about to have a total thyroidectomy, is that it does change during pregnancy. So try to stress to them that during pregnancy, they need to be followed more carefully by either their endocrinologist or OBGYN.
I think I like to think about it in an overview fashion. So the three things I like to think about for pregnant patients are their physiology and how their physiology is going to be different from the non-pregnant patient. And then I like to think about the risk factors for that pregnant patient for surgery versus non-surgery. And then the risk factors for the fetus for surgery versus non-surgery. And so that's kind of how I go about the decision-making in terms of the pregnant patient.
All right, Benella, why don't you move on to telling us about the management of patients with Graves' thyrotoxicosis during pregnancy? Can you review the three general options and then how what we offer may be different in the pregnant patient?
So generally speaking, because of the growing fetus, there are different considerations in the pregnant patient. When we talk about antithyroid drugs, for example, methimazole, that is specifically contraindicated due to fetal toxicity. And while propiothiouracil crosses the placenta, in the smallest possible dose, it is an option in pregnancy. For those patients with allergies and contraindications or noncompliance, and those patients in which medical management becomes complicated because we can't achieve a euthyroid state, it's recommended to engage an endocrinologist or a high-risk maternal-fetal medicine specialist. In terms of antihypertensives, such as beta blockers, these are a little bit understudied, but propranolol is one option that is safe to use in pregnancy. Naturally, because of the radioactive nature of RAI, this is not indicated in the pregnant patient.
So we hear a lot about, or worry a lot about, preterm labor and fetal demise in those operated on during pregnancy in the three trimesters. What are the rates that this occurs, and what's the rate of preterm labor or fetal demise if definitive management is not achieved in pregnant patients with hyperthyroidism or poorly controlled fluctuating thyroiditis?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important question, particularly a prominent concern of the pregnant patient that we see in counsel in the office. And the rates are actually quite variable. They are mentioned in the ATA guidelines, and they range somewhere between 5 to 15%. And so there is a substantial risk of preterm labor and fetal demise for unmanaged or poorly managed hyperthyroidism.
What about this scenario? How would you all handle this? I just saw this patient in clinic recently. She's 31 years old. She has ongoing flares of thyroiditis causing hyperthyroidism and then down to euthyroidism, a little bit of hypothyroidism back up, kind of the usual thyroiditis story. But she's hyperthyroid. She's on PTU. Her hormone levels are controlled. Do you keep her on medication or do you take her thyroid out? You know, she's got a mildly enlarged thyroid gland, but nothing causing any issues right now, you know, well controlled. But who knows if she has another flare or not, or her thyroid just kind of, you know, fizzles out. Slightly firm, but it's not painful. She has no dysphagia or esophageal compression or airway issues. So how would you counsel her? But let me start with, I'll pick on you first, John. What do you think?
So, you know, as we just heard, you know, Graves' disease or even Hashimoto's can be very challenging to manage during pregnancy. And I kind of think of pregnancy as somewhat of a partially immunosuppressed state. And so frequently those diseases can get a lot worse. Sometimes, surprisingly, they can get better. So, you know, I think anybody with certainly significant hyperthyroidism, one of the first things I always stress is try not to get pregnant while you're hyperthyroid. So, I do think surgery is a reasonable option when someone who's certainly planning to get pregnant in the very near future. It, you know, complicates the pregnancy much less. It potentially helps them get pregnant if that's going to be a challenge. You know, hyperthyroidism or hypo can cause some infertility issues. So, I mean, obviously every patient's different and depends on if they're actively trying to have kids or not, but all those are important factors to consider.
Priya, what do you think?
I completely agree. I think it's important, especially in somebody that's having flares, it's going to be more challenging potentially to control those flares during pregnancy. And that could, because the flares might be poorly controlled and you might have highs and lows, that could put the patient at higher risk for fetal demise. So I would counsel the patient to have treatment for the hyperthyroidism before considering getting pregnant.
And obviously the other definitive treatment being radioactive iodine can be problematic because typically we recommend not getting pregnant for 6 months after they have that treatment. So, and if they already have young kids at home, that can pose an extra problem with that.
Yeah, I think another interesting point may be that the patients that we see in clinic, we already have, you know, that decision has already been made to send those patients to us. I know that obviously we're not operating on every patient who's hyperthyroid before they get pregnant. There are thousands of women who are out there who are hyperthyroid and on medication, and the endocrinologist certainly manage these patients. But I think what we brought up are some, you know, interesting points to think about, you know, if they do have a flare. You know, we see patients when they have significant issues, right? So we're probably biased towards one direction potentially to try and ward off some of these difficult situations that we see. So, but there are definitely lots of, you know, options, and you need to think carefully about everything in these patients. All right, let's move on. The evaluation of thyroid nodules is essentially the same in the pregnant patient: ultrasound, labs, bi-needle aspiration if warranted. When we start talking about discussing indeterminate nodules and thyroid cancer. So, John, in your practice, how do you manage a newly diagnosed indeterminate nodule and then a known thyroid cancer during pregnancy?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We know, you know, obviously we've come a long way in our molecular diagnosis of indeterminate nodules, but to my knowledge, that data hasn't been as validated in the pregnant population. So I do have a little bit more concern using that. But in general, for patients with, you know, known thyroid cancer, I try to recommend, you know, watching it through most of their pregnancy, depending on how big it is and how fast it's growing. So I will frequently get, you know, have them come back frequently for ultrasounds to monitor any change. Obviously, you know, we want to operate in the second trimester is kind of the best time to do it.
You know, the data for waiting, it is fine. We know that most thyroid cancers progress slowly. It's not going to change the overall outcome or treatment or survival. And I think the pandemic has added to that data as well, because most of endocrine surgery we ceased to operate during that time. And we know that our patients, you know, really had no significant change. Vanilla, you want to go through some of the data and recommendations from the ATA guidelines?
Yeah, so the 2017 ATA guidelines actually corroborate the things that you've all described as occurring in clinical practice. And so the recommendations for PTC are to continue monitoring the concerning nodule sonographically each trimester. And if there's substantial growth by mid-gestation, which is described as a 50% increase in volume, a 20% increase in diameter, or the occurrence of nodal metastases or concern for nodal metastases, then surgery is recommended and favored, particularly in the second trimester and further. If the nodule cancer in question appears to be stable at the mid-gestational time or is diagnosed in the second half of pregnancy, as you said, John, I think the recommendation would be to operate after delivery. However, if there is concern for medullary or biopsy-proven anaplastic carcinoma, which is concerning, there is a firmer recommendation to proceed to surgery at that time. And the additional recommendation for women with concern for MEN2 is to, of course, exclude the presence of a pheochromocytoma prior to pregnancy. We will discuss adrenal disorders at a later time.
I do think you would treat medullary and anaplastic differently. It's kind of, I would not view them in any way similar. I'd view medullary much more like papillary and anaplastic.
Yeah, I think the important part is risk stratification and determining how fast the cancer is growing. I think any cancer where you're seeing growth during the pregnancy, I would consider operating on the patient. And so that's going to include something like anaplastic thyroid cancer or poorly differentiated thyroid cancer.
And now a word from our sponsor, TrueLearn. The team at Behind the Knife are big fan of TrueLearn's AbCite question bank. The QBank contains over 1,000 practice questions and 600 surgical illustrations, radiology images, and decision-making algorithms, not to mention the more than 440 tables summarizing high-yield topics. TrueLearn's content aligns with the AbCite blueprint and the SCORE curriculum. And TrueLearn uses a test-taking interface that closely mirrors that of the actual AbCite. As Vince Lombardi once said, perfect practice makes perfect. Question explanations are clear and concisely break down why each answer is correct or incorrect. Question answers are also supported by legitimate references, so you can read deeper into topics when needed. And you can also track progress with advanced performance analytics and real-time national benchmarking. On the go, you can use TrueLearn's app for mobile studying, perfect for commutes or a few questions in between cases. TrueLearn is happy to share a discount code just for Behind the Knife listeners. Please check out the show notes for more. You can buy now and activate at any time. Now, back to the pod.
Okay. Well, we said at the beginning that good multidisciplinary communication is key in these cases. So, Priya, how do you work with the OB team in these cases?
So, I try to communicate with the OB team at several different points. So, first, I think the most important point is to communicate with the OB team to determine the risk to the patient and the fetus about operation versus not operation and what the disease process is. So with a thyroid cancer or with Graves' disease, what is going to be the risk to the fetus in terms of, you know, if it's Graves' disease, how well controlled the hormones are. And then on the cancer side, if the cancer is progressing or not. I think the other time to talk to the OB team, and I think it's a good idea to include multiple members of the care team, not just the OB team, is to plan the operation. So if there is going to be an operation, I like to have a multidisciplinary meeting and just do a dry run of what the operation is going to involve and include, if there is going to be a problem, how we're going to deal with the problem. So when is the monitoring going to be, when is fetal monitoring going to be placed? If there's an issue during the operation with fetal monitoring, what will be the next steps, how to deal, like, are we going to stop our operation and then we're going to have the belly already prepped if that's necessary, et cetera. We kind of try to do a dry run based on where the patient is in pregnancy beforehand so that we can know what the plan is going to be in the event of an adverse event.
Yeah, so I think the other thing that I think about it is the, you know, complication side of things, and hypocalcemia is not uncommon in these patients, and you have to think about it's not just the mother, it's the fetus as well, and what a significant hypocalcemia is going to do to the fetus. So something else to consider, which leads us into our next topic here. Before we leave talking about thyroid surgery and pregnancy, I do want to mention that another resource is the American Association of Endocrine Surgeons guidelines on thyroid surgery, and that is available on the AAES website at www.endocrinesurgery.org under the resources tab. So let's shift gears and start talking about primary hyperparathyroidism. This is going to reference clinics in endocrinology and metabolism. All right, Manella, you want to start us off on this by highlighting the physiologic changes during pregnancy impacting calcium and parathyroid homeostasis?
Yeah, so due to all the substantial endocrinologic changes in pregnancy, there are a lot of differences in regulation of calcium homeostasis in the pregnant patient. So due to the natural expansion of plasma volume, there's a reduced level of albumin and therefore a decrease in total calcium values in the gestating patient. And while there is fetal bone mineralization, considerations of maternal vitamin D levels are very critical for a direct reflection of fetal vitamin D status. And due to all the symptomatology of pregnancy, polyuria, fatigue, nausea, and how that kind of mimics the symptoms of hypercalcemia, actually detecting hypercalcemia can be pretty difficult because many pregnant patients experience these symptoms routinely. And so that is one thing to consider on the differential. We do get routine labs in pregnancy initially, and so that may pick these things up. But another thing to consider is pseudohyperparathyroidism due to elevated PTRH-related peptide levels, which occur related to the expanding and growing placenta, as well as enlarging breasts during pregnancy. And these things are not without risk. We do worry in pregnancy the gravid patient about longstanding hypercalcemia risks. So these risks include hypercalcemic crisis, nephrolithiasis, and impairment of renal function, as well as preeclampsia. We do worry additionally about impacts on the fetus, particularly intrauterine polyhydramnios. And then after birth, due to lack of development of the parathyroid glands in a patient where there's maternal hypercalcemia, we worry about dysregulation in the neonatal parathyroid gland, tetany, and ultimately we worry about death of the infant or intrauterine fetal death.
And what about diagnostic modalities and treatment when we see these patients?
So similar to with any patient, we do get a good history and physical, and we also consider the potential for a family history, looking for potential genetic syndromes. Oftentimes, these patients are usually under 40. In looking at biochemical diagnoses, one thing that confounds the diagnosis is that urine calcium can increase in pregnancy as a normal physiologic response. And this is reflected in some of the European Society data we'll review later.
So do we do anything different during evaluation? Do we check ionized calcium levels more than serum calcium levels? Do we check PTHRP levels routinely?
So because of the differences in total calcium levels and reduced albumin levels, we do use ionized calcium levels as a marker in pregnant patients, preferentially over serum calcium levels. Because of the confounding parathyroid hormone-related peptide, there's not really a consensus in measuring those levels routinely, and so that further confounds the diagnosis of hyperparathyroidism in pregnancy. So there is always an option, if there is clinical concern, to do a foreground exploration, but we, you know, would like to minimize the extent of dissection and prolonged surgery in a pregnant woman if possible, and so attempting localization is reasonable, and we do have that technology today. So I'd start, I think, with a neck ultrasound in a patient that's pregnant. Clearly CT or any use of ionized contrast is contraindicated. And so the option of a 4D CT here is limited. And so you can use a sestamibi scan with dose reduction that is feasible. And if necessary, you can also use MRI because that doesn't have any ionizing radiation. So that is one consideration. But I think I'd start with a good old fashioned neck ultrasound.
All right. So in, you know, would the medical management be indicated in any of these, Vanilla? And if so, what potential medications could be used and other conservative management strategies?
Conservative management approaches like oral and IV hydration are certainly options throughout the pregnancy to maintain hypercalcemia. With respect to medications, the jury's out on cinacalcet. There is some data that suggests it is safe in pregnancy, but it is nebulous at this time. However, we do know that bisphosphonates and denosumab are contraindicated in pregnancy. And so our options in pregnancy here are limited due to fetal risk.
Okay. And then obviously we have surgical management. And if we can keep to a directed or focused approach, that's great. But certainly if you need to do foreground exploration, that's obviously been the gold standard for a long time. And to certainly something that we all should know how to do. Priya, why don't you tell us a little bit about your decision-making regarding conservative treatment versus parathyroid surgery in pregnancy?
I think the couple of things that drive my decision-making for that are the level of the calcium and the level of the PTH, more so the level of the calcium. So if it's over, like with an albumin-corrected level of over 11, then that's a time where I would start thinking about an operation. Whereas if it's lower than 11, then I'm less likely to consider an operation because it's more likely to be able to be medically managed.
John, what about you?
Yeah, I agree. I think when it's relatively mild disease, I would much prefer to manage it medically. But if it's significant, clearly causing symptoms, then I think you're bound to operate on it.
Yeah. I tend to operate, I think, on most of them in out of concern for the loss of the pregnancy. So I tend to be a little bit more aggressive. I do some of these under local anesthesia and I haven't had any major issues. Worry about the parathyroid development in the fetus as well. Never know exactly, you know, what level is going to prevent or cause any of those types of issues. So different strategies and all, you know, backed up by various types of data. So Danella, why don't you tell us a little bit about the differences in some of the papers that we pulled for this podcast?
So there are varying recommendations in terms of parathyroid surgery in pregnancy. A lot of the data that exists presently is based on observational studies. And there is a systematic review of 382 patients that was performed by Sandler et al. In an ear, nose, and throat journal. And they found a significantly lower complication rate for surgery versus conventional therapy. So the current literature actually strongly favors surgery, while reviews prior to 2010 offer disparate reviews. There is a European Society of Endocrinology program for parathyroid disorders, or PARET, and they do recommend surgery, particularly if albumin-adjusted calcium is greater than 2.85, so they provide some more stringent criteria, and if ionized calcium levels are greater than 1.45. And so generally speaking, the literature does vary, but the majority advise, as we've described in this podcast, favoring surgery if indicated during pregnancy.
Yeah, and the numbers that you quoted are millimoles per liter. So when we translate that to the albumin-adjusted calcium, it's greater than 11.4 milligrams per deciliter, and ionized calcium, which is greater than 5.81 milligrams per deciliter, depending on what your lab uses for values. You want to elaborate a little bit on this and tell us about the case series by Mullen from Australia, which was published in 2010?
Yeah, so Mullen et al. Actually described a series of 7 patients, all pregnant women, between the period of 1992 to 2007. And there's really like a beautiful and elaborate description of each of the courses of these patients and the clinical management. And ultimately, the consensus is that maternal and fetal complications are actually difficult to predict based on the actual serum calcium level. And so those values are not necessarily predictive or reliable in terms of risk. And we talk a lot about risk stratification. So they do say that when treated surgically, the overall neonatal complication rate that they found was much lower than what was documented for conservative therapy at about 10 to 20%. And so that further supports the discussion of proceeding towards surgery in pregnant women with hyperparathyroidism.
All right, great. Well, I think that's been a great general overview of a topic that can be stressful for all involved. Pregnancy is a unique physiologic condition that compounds the risks inherent to endocrine disorders needing surgical treatment, and the decision-making can be complex. Evaluation and management can be different due to maternal-fetal needs and medical treatments or procedures that may have teratogenic effects or increased risk of fetal demise. Surgical decision-making must balance the risks and benefits to the mother and the fetus. Thanks for joining us, and stay tuned for part 2 of Endocrine Disorders in Pregnancy.
Dominate the day!
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.